Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Tonight we are going to welcome Jeffrey Richelson and Mike Schuster to discuss Diffusing Armageddon, Inside Nest, America's Secret Nuclear Bomb Squad. Before I start, just a few things. If you would first turn off your cell phones and pagers, that would be great. I wanted to make sure that you all knew that the Allowed series is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which makes possible all of these free Allowed series programs. And I want to thank those of you who already are library associates or who have donated to help support these programs, and to point out that there is a jar out there in the lobby, and we do want to keep these programs going, and we really appreciate your support. Allowed is does not receive any city funding, and you know, these are hard times for anyone, and we really appreciate your support, so thank you very much on that. And also wanted to mention, as I've been mentioning, tomorrow night's program with Gustav Neighbor and Ibu Patel on interfaith social action. We had to cancel, and we're hoping to reschedule that in the fall, so please stay tuned on that. So, two decades, as I said, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Russia and the United States together still have more than 20,000 nuclear weapons. Tonight, when Jeffrey Richelson discusses his new book about NEST, America's Secret Nuclear Bomb Squad, he'll give us a behind-the-scenes look at the history of the Nuclear Emergency Support Team. What happens when there's a nuclear threat to Los Angeles, New York, or New Orleans? How did NEST operate during the Cold War, and how has it evolved? Those are some of the issues that Dr. Richelson will discuss tonight with NPR foreign correspondent Mike Schuster. Jeffrey C. Richelson is the author of several books on intelligence, including Spying on the Bomb. He is currently a senior fellow with the National Security Archive. He directed archive documentation projects on U.S.-China relations, the organization and operations of the U.S. intelligence community, U.S. military space activities, and presidential national security directives. In conversation with him, Mike Schuster is a diplomatic correspondent and roving foreign correspondent for NPR. He's based here in Los Angeles. And when he's not traveling outside the U.S., he covers issues of nuclear nonproliferation and weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and the Pacific Rim. In the past 2 years, he's contributed many reports to NPR's extensive coverage of the Middle East, and he's traveled many times to Israel and Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. You always know you're in good hands when Mike is moderating. So without further ado, please welcome Jeffrey Richelson and Mike Schuster. Thank you very much.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's nice to be back to participate in Allowed, which I think is a terrific series. And I want to welcome Jeffrey back. This is the second time Jeffrey's been here. He has a previous book called Spying on the Bomb, and we talked to him nearly 3 years ago about that on this stage. But tonight the discussion is about his most recent book, Diffusing Armageddon, the story of the NEST. And I'll just mention that the actual organization that was the NEST began in the mid-1970s, but there's some history that comes before that. The discussion of what the NEST eventually addressed began with something called the Screwdriver Report. Tell us what the Screwdriver Report was.
Well, really, I guess the origins of this were a secret hearing which Robert Oppenheimer attended in 1946. He was a witness. And a senator asked him, you know, could somebody smuggle a nuclear weapon into the United States, and what equipment would you use to find it? And he said, well, they certainly could, and the appropriate equipment would be a screwdriver. And the reason he said that was because you needed a screwdriver to open up every single crate or box that was shipped into the United States. As a result of that, he asked Wolfgang Panofsky to do a study as to how the U.S. could detect people smuggling in nuclear weapons or radioactive material that might be used in a hostile manner. And so Panofsky wrote this report, and the result of it was a series of radiation detectors placed around airports in the United States.
And how early was that?
This was in the 1950s that this was being done. And as far as we know, the single accomplishment of this was detecting a woman who was smuggling in wristwatches with radium dials. And so that program eventually ended.
But this became more serious when nuclear accidents began to happen. What does Broken Arrow mean?
It means a lost nuclear weapon.
And there have been nuclear weapons that have been lost.
Yes, there were a number of incidents. Probably the two most significant ones. One was Palomares, Spain, in 1966, in which there was a B-52 bomber on its patrol. It was supposed to be refueled, and unfortunately, there was a very serious collision between the bomber and the KC-135 tanker that carried the fuel. The tanker exploded, and everybody was lost. The B-52, some of the people survived. All the bombs landed, either three of the bombs landed in this small village, near this small village in Spain, Palomares. One landed in the ocean, which was eventually recovered. And so there was no actual radiation damage as a result of it, but it was a big public relations disaster for the United States, and it involved a great deal of expense, and it involved people going around with radiation detection equipment looking for the bombs.
And there was another one in Greenland, but there was also one off the coast of the United States in Georgia, right?
There was one in where a plane was coming back from a practice mission, and it was under the impression that after it passed a certain point, its mission was done. Unfortunately, there were fighter pilots who were told differently, and were told as part of the practice mission they could attack it. The eventual result was a collision. And the pilot eventually had to jettison the bomb because he was told that if he landed at the airfield, there was some problems with the airfield and the bomb might go shooting out the plane, and they didn't want that, so they had to jettison it.
So he was carrying a single nuclear weapon?
As far as I recall, mm-hmm. It was a single nuclear weapon. And several years later, in fact, quite recently, they tried again to locate the bomb and eventually gave up and decided that they were going to just... Wherever it was, and nobody was ever going to find it.
So the connection to the nest was that the government needed a team of specialists to deal with accidents and any other things that might arise involving nuclear weapons. Is that the genesis of it?
Well, there were the events we've talked about were part of the genesis. There was also this concern, starting in the early 50s and going through the 60s, that either the Soviet Union or China might smuggle in nuclear devices to be used either as part of a war or part of some other incident. And there were even these sort of, I guess, fantasies that were staple of a lot of movies and books in the 1960s about China smuggling in a nuclear device, trying to make it appear that the Soviet Union did it, blow it up, or have it found and cause a crisis between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. All these things played into the need for two types of detection. One was a response to an accident, and as a result of that, the predecessor to the Department of Energy, Atomic Energy Commission, formed an accident response group. And these were people who were trained in various aspects of physics and nuclear weapons, and when there would be an accident, they would go out and locate or try to locate the weapons and make sure that they were not about to detonate. If there was some problem, they would try to solve the problem and essentially turn them off. Then you also had this concern over nuclear terrorism, and some of these incidents, and that eventually led to NEST as a result of the Boston incident in 1974.
Talk about that a little bit, because that gave rise, in effect, to the task force that was created and then became formally the NEST within the next couple of years.
Right. There had been a couple of previous incidents where somebody had threatened a city or a state with nuclear destruction unless they paid up. The first incident was 1970. A 14-year-old boy in Orlando, Florida, sent a letter to the police department saying, pay up or else. And they asked for some information to validate that he knew that this person actually had some knowledge of nuclear weapons, and they convinced at least an officer at a base nearby that he did. But that didn't lead to any organizational changes. Then in May of 1974, the U.S. got a threat saying, we have a nuclear device planted in Boston. If you don't drop X number of dollars, I think it was $200,000 at this site, and don't arrest us or anything, it's going to go off. So as a response, as a result of that, a man named William Chambers got a phone call. And William Chambers was somebody who had been involved in the looking in Palomares for nuclear weapons. He was somebody who, after that, started worrying and wondering, how well could we do if it was a hostile force that had this nuclear weapon, a foreign nation's agents or a terrorist group, and could we find it? So he had been doing work and experiments and trying to develop a detection system and a detection technology. So naturally, he at Los Alamos got this call, and it was sort of like, you know, if you watched Mission Impossible in the 1960s, he's told, assemble a team of people. You know, you could see him sitting there with the folder saying him, not him, and get him to Boston. And he did part of that. He assembled a team, and they got to an Air Force base in New York. They had a lot of problems in terms of putting the equipment in the vans that they were going to use. But as it turned out, the whole thing was settled before they ever got to Boston.
It was a hoax.
As all of them, fortunately, have been, they've been hoaxes.
But this concept of nuclear extortion became real for the government at any rate.
It became very real, and as a result of that incident, the head of the Nevada Operations Office received a directive from the Atomic Energy Commission to establish a team that in future cases could go out and try to locate a nuclear device or radiological material, whatever, whenever somebody was threatening to detonate it or distribute it.
And so the NEST, then named Nuclear Emergency Search Team, was a secret task force under President Ford, but became the government acknowledged it as a separate organization under President Carter. Is that right?
In 1977, as they describe it, somebody quietly left a press release on a press table announcing that NEST existed, and you know, about another page of information about what type of people were involved and what its activities were. And as it was explained to me, the people involved in NEST, senior people, realized that if there is a nuclear incident, if we do have to go out in the streets looking for a nuclear device, we're going to need the cooperation of local law enforcement and people at the local level. And we can't do this if we're a secret organization. It just wouldn't work. So therefore, they had to acknowledge their existence.
Your book leaves me with the impression that once they were established, they had plenty of work. There were a lot of incidents in the late 1970s and through the 1980s. It wasn't as if something was happening every week. But there were significant challenges all through that period.
Yes. There were two types of activities they were basically engaged in. One was they did a lot of exercises. So they went out into Idaho or somewhere. One was in downtown L.A. Others were in Indianapolis and other cities where they operated with the FBI, military groups, in trying to determine or sort of play out how they would deal with such an incident. But then there were some real incidents also. In 1975, the head of Union Oil in Los Angeles got a letter saying, I have planted a nuclear device in one of your properties. I want so much money or else. It was, in a way, almost funny in that the letter had so many misspellings that you wouldn't think the person could, you know, program their VCR if they had VCRs then, much less build a nuclear device. And in fact, at the bottom of the letter, one of the things that's very amusing is that he writes, sorry for the poorly typed letter, but unfortunately we couldn't get a secretary to do this. But in any case, the threat was taken very seriously. The FBI went out and went to the phone booths they were supposed to go to. They actually saw somebody leaving another phone booth exactly when the call ended, and they followed him, and eventually he was found guilty and sent to jail. But Ness was involved because they were searching all the properties to see if there was something there. And at one point they found some strange-looking box, and everybody was very worried that, this was it. And it wasn't it. The only thing radioactive they found was a piece of uranium, which was a souvenir in one of the executives' desks. Then in 1979 in Wilmington, North Carolina, somebody who worked at a GE plant went in there one night, took a couple of barrels of low-enriched uranium out, buried them in a field nearby, and then dropped a letter in front of the door of the plant manager saying, "I've stolen this material. Unless I get my money, I'm going to send it out to anti-nuclear groups, and this is really not going to do the GE or the nuclear industry very much good. It's going to be a severe black eye."
And that was the first time that there was actual nuclear material involved in one of these extortion threats.
Right, exactly. And that was something that led some of the Ness people to worry, where are we going from here? First we had threats with nothing behind them, and now we actually have some nuclear material. And one of the things that's interesting about that is that some of the documents I was able to get under the Freedom of Information Act represent the psycholinguistic analysis of the threat. And there was this professor at Syracuse who worked with Ness, Murray Myron, who did a lot of this work. And when you read the analysis, it was, pretty on target in terms of what type of person did it, what his motivation was, whether he worked for the company or not, et cetera, et cetera. But Nest also went out and looking for this, but again, the FBI nailed the guy so quickly that they didn't really have time to find anything.
Then the Nest began to deal with a wider array of problems. That one had to do with a Soviet satellite that was breaking up and that fell over Canada, right?
Right. In January of, well, in, it was December of 1977 when the Soviets launched a satellite known as Cosmos 954. And this was a satellite whose mission was to track U.S. naval movements. And as a source of power, it had a nuclear reactor on board, because in order to generate the power to operate the radar, and they wanted a radar system that would bounce signals off the vehicles and then gather them back and turn that into intelligence, you couldn't just use solar power. There wouldn't be enough power generated. So they had a nuclear reactor on board. And sometime, not all that long after it went up into orbit, it started being sort of acting in a rather peculiar manner. And U.S. space trackers started noticing that its orbit wasn't stable, that things were getting worrisome. And at first the Soviets denied that there was anything wrong, but eventually acknowledged that there was a problem, and that rather than being able to boost it into a higher orbit, which they usually did with such satellites where it would stay up there for several hundreds of years, it was headed back to Earth. And of course the question was where, since you don't know, a satellite that's out of control, you don't know where exactly it's going to land. So the U.S. and other countries followed its path. And even in the last 12 hours, it was going to land in Hawaii, it was going to land someplace else. Eventually, it landed in Canada. And President Carter offered Prime Minister Trudeau U.S. assets to try to find it. And part of this was, some of this was U-2 aircraft and WC-135 aircraft, which could either photograph Canadian territory or detect signs of radiation. But they also offered Nest. And a large contingent, I think it was over 100 people from Nest, went up there in the Yellowknife area of the Canadian Northwest Territories, where you have a lot of space and virtually no people. And they flew in helicopters. They brought their detection equipment, and they flew in helicopters, and they flew on aircraft. And they monitored the radiation or the signals that were obtained to see if there was any sign of radiation. And eventually, over a period of time, I guess it was a month or so, they were able to pinpoint where the pieces of this satellite were and scoop them up.
This presumably had a benefit to clean up the potential radioactive mess, but presumably there was also an intelligence benefit to the United States from getting our hands on at least parts of a modern Soviet satellite.
Right. Certainly, initially and during the cleanup operation, the U.S. or the people in charge of the operation tried to sort of keep intelligence out of it. There was one person from the Los Alamos Technical Intelligence Division who showed up and was told to get back on the plane and go home. But eventually, certainly, the equipment was, the pieces were gathered up. And I know of at least one report done by Livermore on the reactor, based on what was recovered. What is now the National Air and Space Intelligence Center, which at that time was known as the Foreign Technology Division, apparently has over 100 reports that they've produced on the subject, which I'm still waiting to get under the FOIA.
There was another incident in the 1980s that I hadn't known about, and I found it fascinating. The nest had something to do with Bernhard Goetz, the New York subway gunman who shot some kids in the subway in the mid-80s, and it became a national story. What was the nest connection to that?
Well, that was probably also the first example of a nest responding to a threat that was not give-me-your-money type threat. It was really a political extortion threat. And the mayor of New York received a letter saying that if Goetz goes on trial, if he gets convicted, et cetera, we're going to poison the New York water supply with plutonium. And at some point, Nest went out there and did a survey. And at some point, they did find that the plutonium levels had increased, but it was such a small increase that it wasn't threatening, and it wasn't clear where it exactly came from. Was something else in the atmosphere or whatever, but they did go out and they did find this stuff, and that was the end of it. Certainly they never found the people involved in the threat.
So those are the kinds of things that the Nest was dealing with in its sort of initial phase. With the end of the Cold War, things change for the Nest, it seems to me. Its mission changes, especially when we learned about loose nuclear material in Russia, the insecurity about plutonium and uranium in Russia, even potentially nuclear warheads. And that became more of a focus in the 1990s. Is that right?
Well, it was really around the mid-1990s. And what happened was there was essentially a battle, say, sort of for the heart and soul of Nest, if you want to put it that way, between the people in Nevada and people in Washington. And
Nevada being the western, at Nellis Air Force Base, the
where
western
Nest
headquarters is. Yeah.
Right, and I should explain that where the people from Nest come from, I guess,
yeah.
Which is that these aren't people, with maybe a couple of people, who actually work for Nest day-to-day on a full-time basis. What they are scientists and technicians, physicists, everything from nuclear weapons physics to health physics, who work at Los Alamos and Livermore and Sandia National Labs, and also who work for a number of Department of Energy contractors. And today there are maybe about 850 to 1,000 of these people. And if there is an incident, some small subgroup of those can be called upon to drop whatever they're doing and head off to whether it's New Orleans or New York or even China for the Olympics.
So after the end of the Cold War, there was an argument within the government about what the mission of Nest should be,
and,
what the priority for
essentially
Nest should be.
Who should control it. Mm-hmm. Nominally, the control for Nest was the Department of Energy and the Office of Emergency Response, but it was sort of a benign neglect situation. And then after an exercise known as Mirage Gold in 1994, there was really a battle and a shift of power to Washington and to the Office of Emergency Response. And that battle was tied up with the view, at least by the emergency response people and people in Washington, that Nest was too wedded to the old model of dealing with nuclear extortion, of getting a letter which would give them time to go out to a city and try to find something, and that the more relevant model was nuclear terrorism, and that was something where people wouldn't be giving you necessarily a warning, where their sole purpose would be to detonate a device, and therefore NEST had to be more attuned to that type of threat than the nuclear extortion threat. Now, if you talk to the people from Los Alamos, they don't think it's that clear a cut of, that there was that clear a cut of a difference between mm-hmm. them and Washington. But you know, perceptions are what they are, perceptions, and they often influence the outcome of these battles.
You mentioned this exercise, Mirage Golden. You spend a fair amount of time in the book discussing it, and I think it's an interesting thing. I mean, this was an exercise; it wasn't an actual threat. But its implications were far-reaching, it seems to me.
Right. Mirage Gold was an exercise that took place in New Orleans in 1994. And it involved not only NEST, but the FBI, the FBI hostage rescue team, and so forth. So it was many hundreds of people. And part of the point of the exercise was, can all these organizations work and play well together? Which the answer was, to some extent, no. But the exercise involved a fictional threat, this domestic group called the Patriots for National Unity. The FBI learns that they have at least one or more nuclear devices in the New Orleans area. One turns out to be on a boat, one is on land. And once they find out that there is this threat, they alert NEST, who is then supposed to go out, drive around, find the devices, disable them, and make sure nothing bad happens to the residents. After the exercise was over, there was a memo produced or written by his title is too long, it's like 13 words, but it was something like Deputy Assistant Secretary for Military Applications of the Department of Energy. And it was what, if you read in the press, they describe as scathing, brutal, etc. And it challenged the integrity of the NEST leadership, question whether NEST would be effective. And part of his complaint was that, people in NEST knew too much for this really to be a test. They were given clues as to where to find the device. They were allowed to pile up or deliver all their communications equipment to New Orleans well in advance of the FBI alerting them. So it wasn't a real test. It was the type of thing where you get the proper answer, but it wouldn't be, it's not a real reflection of what would happen in the real world. And so he commissioned a report by Dwayne Sewell, who was involved in the nuclear program from the beginning, which actually, when it was produced, didn't talk much about Mirage Gold, but the incident was really the catalyst for this shift of power and this demand that NEST be more attuned to the terrorist threat and also that it conduct exercises that the people in Washington considered more realistic. Now, the people in Los Alamos and elsewhere had a different view of this, but ultimately it was the people in Washington who had the power, and this was really the part of the shift of power from Nevada to Washington.
And then 9/11 comes along and obviously seriously underlines that issue. What's fascinating is that NEST was involved in nuclear terrorism exercises on the day that 9/11 happened, right?
Right. In England, in a base called Fairford, there was an exercise going on known as Jackal Cave. And I don't know, I forget exactly how many NEST people were involved, but it was certainly a significant contingent. They were involved with, there was NEST and there was Delta Force and a number of other units that were looking to recover and disable and transport a fictional nuclear device. And 9/11 happened right in the middle of that, so the exercise obviously was canceled, and all the people were back in the United States within a few days. And by that time, the people from the United States who were in NEST, who were still in the United States, had gone to New York and looked around the World Trade Center to see if there was any signs of a dirty bomb.
Yeah, there was in fact a perceived threat that in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks in New York, there might be a radiological device of some kind as a sort of second wave of the attacks?
Well, there was a, I think it was early October, where the Daily Threat Matrix, which was this top secret document given to the president, reported on a source known as Dragonfire. And Dragonfire claimed that there was a 10 kiloton nuclear weapon headed for New York. Obviously, this kind of upset people. And one of the things that made it seem credible at the time, or to some extent, was that there was also a report that a Russian general said that one of his 10 kiloton devices had turned up missing. It turned out that Dragonfire had no real credibility, and the source was, I guess, fairly quickly discredited. But there was some anxious times and some, you know, NEST searching.
This raises the issue of the intelligence contribution to the NEST, because especially in the aftermath of 9/11, the focus of the NEST has been on combating nuclear terrorism and learning beforehand when there's a threat, not simply waiting for something to happen or dispersing radiation detection equipment, which there can never be, presumably there could never be enough of. Can you talk a little bit about the intelligence component of what the NEST is now?
Well, there are people in NEST who have access and will go down and read the intelligence reports on terrorist groups, on their attempts to acquire nuclear material, that sort of thing. But probably the biggest importance, the biggest relationship of NEST to intelligence is as a consumer. Because when you're dealing with a terrorist group that's not going to give you any warning, then the intelligence component become all important. So without CIA or NSA or somebody providing warning that a group is planning to smuggle a device into New York City or someplace else, if they get it there, it may be too late to find them, particularly if it's a nuclear device, because the signatures from a nuclear device, whether it's a uranium bomb or plutonium bomb, are not all that great. So it can be very hard to find if you can't narrow down the area where that device is. So that means either the CIA or NSA in terms of foreign intelligence or the FBI domestically. It's much easier to find a dirty bomb, but the standard nuclear device would be a problem.
And that, of course, raises a lot of questions that we've actually discussed here and with other authors as well, about the intelligence that the American intelligence community gathers on nuclear terrorism. Did you find in the research that you've done for this book that you feel confident that the U.S. intelligence community, through intelligence methods, can gather the necessary information that could be ultimately provided to NEST to combat this?
I think certainly they have a large number of resources to do that. And if you're talking about a group going out and actually acquiring fissile material and building a bomb itself, then that's a prolonged process and there are a lot of signatures involved, whether it be financial transfers or buying land or buying equipment to build a bomb. And that increases the probability that you could detect it.
This can come to the attention of local police authorities and the intelligence world.
It come to the attention of 7 or 8 different agencies in the intelligence community, depending on what particular aspect of this effort they would be monitoring. If it was a case of a country giving a nuclear weapon to a particular group, or they're somehow being able to acquire it with it not being known, that would be much more difficult, because the signatures wouldn't be there that you have when you try to actually build a bomb. So I can't say. Certainly there are, there's a lot of attention devoted to worrying about this. I mean, certainly we collect intelligence on the security of nuclear weapons in Pakistan and Russia and all sorts of places. The National Intelligence Council is charged on a yearly basis with producing a report, and you can look on the CIA National Intelligence Council website and find it, producing a report on the security of nuclear weapons and nuclear material in Russia. But I don't think you can ever say that there's no possibility that somebody could steal a weapon or be given a weapon and that it would be detected. I mean, it would not be detected. There's always some possibility.
Since 9/11, there was much written and discussed about Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda's interest in acquiring a nuclear weapon to explode in the United States and bin Laden himself. Did you come to any conclusion about that? Because this has been an issue that's been before Nest and concerned Nest even before 9/11.
I certainly think if you read the fatwas, if you read just all the accounts of Al-Qaeda's nuclear and WMD activity, I certainly think it's clear that they would like to have one. I don't think there's any doubt about that, and that they would be willing to go to some trouble to acquire one. And you have numerous talks with Pakistani scientists who had various levels of knowledge of how to build a nuclear weapon. You had attempts for them to acquire nuclear material in the Sudan. You had, they're sort of asking for a blessing of the Saudi cleric. How many people can we kill? Well, you came up with 4 million, I think it was the answer. So I don't think there's any, and you look at the papers that were discovered in Afghanistan after the U.S. invasion there. I don't have any doubt that they would like to acquire one. Fortunately, I don't believe the scare stories that they have an arsenal that makes them the world's second greatest nuclear power or something. I mean, you can find stories that say they acquired Russian backpack nukes, that the MS-13 street gang has smuggled in nuclear weapons for them, that they bought 40 from the Chechens. And, unless they're waiting for the tricentennial, I think it's fairly clear they don't have them now, because I certainly would think they would have used them. Uh-huh. Are they interested in them? Yeah, yes. This is what all the intelligence reports also say. Have they gotten close to actually having a capability? I think the answer is at this point no, at least as far as I know.
There, in the aftermath of 9/11, and as Nest developed and focused more on combating nuclear terrorism, there have also been some controversies about some of its activities. And one of the most interesting that I found in your book was the information that in 2002, a combination of the FBI and Nest were monitoring mosques and other public institutions in Washington, D.C., and that they were monitoring many U.S. citizens who were going to the mosques without search warrants and without court orders, and that the Nest took part in this. Okay. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The Nest wasn't monitoring U.S. citizens specifically, but what it was doing was taking radiation detection equipment in a van and driving up near Muslim facilities, including particularly mosques. And this was in Washington, New York, a number of major U.S. cities. And when this was revealed, there was a certain controversy over it as to whether they were conducting, unauthorized searches. And the Department of Justice Nest view was, we're driving a van into a parking lot or a public street, and we're sitting there, and we're seeing if there's any radiation that arrives, and it's not directional. The Supreme Court case that's sort of relevant to this is a case involving somebody named Danny Kylo, which took place in Oregon. And he was somebody that somebody who worked for the Department of Interior suspected of growing marijuana in his house. So along with a local police officer, they got this device, thermal imaging device, that was able to pinpoint, heat sources in somebody's house. And eventually that went to the Supreme Court, and by a 5-4 decision, which I guess all of them are now, they concluded that was a warrantless search and therefore was prohibited, because they weren't simply passively receiving information from the neighborhood, but they were looking into somebody's house. And without a search warrant, that was prohibited.
Did the Nest use similar technology in some of its surveillance?
Not as far as I know. I mean, as far as I know, what they were doing, they were using their radiation detection equipment to see if they were getting a, you know, sort of flood of neutrons or other radioactive material that might indicate somebody was building a dirty bomb or had a nuclear device. And so that's why they've argued that this is not illegal and it's not a search as the Kylo case was.
Do you therefore believe that Nest continues to do that kind of surveillance?
They might, but last I knew that program had sort of ended a while ago.
A number of other things the Nest has been involved in recent years. Some from the Nest went to Iraq to look for weapons of mass destruction as part of the Iraq survey group, right?
Yes, they obviously have a skill in terms of locating nuclear material. They didn't go there as a Nest group. They just went. Some people just went.
And you mentioned the Olympics. You mentioned China, the Olympics in China. Your book says that the Nest did take part in helping to protect the Athens Olympics, but that China, if I remember correctly, didn't want the Nest to be involved.
No, they did go.
Oh, they did go.
And that's part of a, talking about post 9/11, mm-hmm. although this actually started a little before, Nest has been involved to a much greater extent in these recent years in precautionary deployments, not waiting to get a threat. But there are these class of events in the United States, which was designated as a result of a Clinton administration presidential directive titled National Special Security Events. And basically, they're any event that terrorists might look at and say, boy, I'd like to blow that up. And so it involves, it's the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, the Super Bowl, political conventions, economic summits, G8 economic summits, meetings of oil ministers. And so Nest now often will go out, they'll do a preliminary scan of the area to map the radiation levels, and then subsequently will go back at the time of the event and see if anything's changed, see if there's any warning signs. And this also has been extended abroad, where they've done this in foreign countries such as Greece and Beijing and China.
Now, what about if something happens in a foreign country that suggests that someone is trying to acquire dangerous nuclear material or warheads of some kind? You mentioned this, the South African incident, Pelindaba, a couple of years ago when the facility that has special nuclear material in South Africa in effect was penetrated by two teams of gunmen. They shot one of the guards or one of the personnel there, and it's mysterious. We don't know exactly what happened. But did the Nest then get involved after the fact in trying to determine exactly what was going on and what might have been taken?
As far as I know, not at all. I mean, that would be something that I think would be handled by intelligence agencies.
And so the Nest, you don't think, was necessarily brought in on that?
I certainly have not come across any suggestion that there was.
You also mentioned Pakistan and the concern about Pakistan. Has there been a role for Nest in looking at the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons?
Well, not as far as I know. I mean, the question I raise there is, you know, you hear about U.S. having contingency plans if things really go to hell in Pakistan and everything descends into chaos and we're afraid of the wrong people getting hold of them. And if that were the case, there's a potential role for Nest in going in there. Whether they would or not, you know, I don't know. Some people would say that's not what they signed up for. Mm-hmm. But there's always the possibility that some people would be going there along with military groups in order to find exactly where the nuclear weapons were and help get them out.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we'll open it up to the audience. And basically, how good has the Nest become? How good are they now at protecting the United States from nuclear terrorism? It's been a long history now, and they've been through a number of iterations. Their technology has changed. Their intelligence has changed. How good have they become?
Well, probably the best answer is hopefully we'll never know, because we haven't yet actually had a nuclear weapon on U.S. soil for a terrorist group. I think you can say certainly they have a lot of very skilled people working for them, and probably the best group of people you could get out there to deal with this. How well they'll do in a particular incident depends on a lot of variables, like what intelligence they have, what type of bomb is involved. A dirty bomb is much easier to find, as I mentioned, than an actual nuclear device. How good the terrorists are in terms of shielding the material. So it's going to depend on a lot of variables, and I don't know that you can say, as one report said, to count on a zero yield, is being too optimistic for every incident.
And did you come to a conclusion about the seriousness of the threat? How serious a threat is nuclear terrorism inside the United States?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of different schools of thought there. There's one that says it's not a matter of if, but when. That statement alone doesn't say anything more than it'll happen sometime before the sun explodes. That's a fairly wide range of time. And then there's another school of thought, almost on the opposite of extreme, which is that it's virtually a zero probability after 9/11 because the additional protection that and additional security measures that the U.S. and other countries have engaged in. I certainly don't think it's inevitable. I don't think I think that people who say that are basing it on their conclusion, on their feeling that not enough has been done and there's all this material out there. But, it hasn't happened yet, and you would have thought that something, at least a dirty bomb, would have happened now if there was that high a probability. In fact, I did some calculations just to illustrate the point. If you assume that there's a 50-50 chance of there being a nuclear terrorist attack in any year, then over a 10-year period, the probability that there will be at least one is 0.999. And if you want to look at it for 7 years, which is 9/11, we're past that with regard to 9/11, then the probability is 0.992. So the fact that it hasn't occurred yet, maybe the probability isn't that high. And even if the probability of it not occurring were 0.75, the probability that it would have occurred within 7 years is something like 0.87. And again, that hasn't occurred. So maybe we're better off than we think. But I also think that it's very important that being, sort of cautiously optimistic about the probability shouldn't mean that the government is less vigilant. I mean, it's because part of the fact that we haven't had that attack may well be all the extra measures that have been undertaken in terms of, locking up and securing nuclear weapons and material in Russia and other places, establishing radiation detectors at borders, increasing NEST capability, devoting more intelligence to it. So it's sort of the thing where I'd say, ordinary citizens shouldn't lose any sleep over it, but we want a substantial number of people in the government who do lose sleep over it. And that's the best way of probably preventing it.
Well, let's give the audience a chance to ask Jeffrey some questions. There is a microphone there, and all you have to do is raise your hand, and I'll call on you, and we'll get some questions. How about this woman right here first?
I know that the ports of the U.S. are a concern for terrorism, and in particular the port of Los Angeles. And I was just wondering, how involved is NEST in preventing any equipment coming in, any nuclear equipment coming in through the ports?
Well, they would certainly, if there was fear that something was coming, heading towards them, be out examining a ship if it was suspicious. And in fact, there was an incident in New York, I think it was September 2002, with a ship where there appeared to be radioactive material, and NEST went out and found that it was just ceramic tiles that was giving off the radioactivity. There was an incident where some ships left the port of Colombo in Asia, and there was some signature that involved, there was some nuclear material there, and NEST went out and searched the ships and looked around and used its equipment and concluded that there was no threat. Certainly, there's radiation detection at the port of Los Angeles, at Port of Long Beach, but that isn't a NEST function. There's also a new or post 9/11 entity in the government called the Domestic Nuclear Detection Office. And they're the people that are in charge of building all these new portals for radiation detection and installing them and testing them. So that's more their responsibility than NEST's.
And that's within the Department of Homeland Security.
Yes.
This brings up the question of bureaucratic turf wars, and different offices often get involved in fighting one another for limited money and for parts of the mission. Has that happened in this case?
Well, not that I'm aware of. I mean, I haven't come across anything indicating that there's been sort of any battle between what's called DNDO or DINDO and NEST. And they are doing somewhat different things. I mean, the biggest bureaucratic change is that ostensibly with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, there's now something called the Nuclear Incident Response Team that reports to the Secretary, which is really nothing other than NEST and other units in other departments that the Secretary can call on in the event of an emergency.
Another question back there.
I'm curious to know if there are any foreign governments, international organizations that have an equivalent capability to NEST. Is there, for example, a NATO NEST or UK NEST? And for that matter, have any American policymakers considered developing capable organizations in, say, Afghanistan and Pakistan to fulfill similar responsibilities?
Well, I didn't really research that very much, but I came across certainly indications that there is that type of capability, say, within atomic energy commissions or radiation protection authorities. There's this paper, I think it was in Health Physics Journal, on the Greek Olympics, and they described the Greek government effort, and there was some teams from the Atomic Energy Commission that did NEST type of activities. And I also know that there have been exercises in Europe that involved radiation detection activities conducted by the Swedes and the Finns and all sorts of other European governments. So somewhere in these governments, they have these capabilities, although they may not be as extensive as NEST and as separable as NEST.
Is there a counterpart in Russia?
There may be, but I don't know. I mean, there's certainly there's the last I heard is Ministry of Atomic Energy, and that probably might have some force, but I don't know.
Another question down here.
Back in, I believe it was the 70s, it was variously reported that there appeared to have been some sort of nuclear detonation or explosion or event in the South Atlantic. And there was speculation about the South Africans, about the Israelis, etc. I've never heard anything like that before or since. Do you know anything about that?
Well, Jeffrey has written about this a lot in his last book, and we talked about that when you were here before.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter in my last book about it. What happened in a nutshell was a U.S. Nuclear detection satellite detected what appeared to be a double flash indicative of a nuclear explosion off the South Atlantic in September of 79. And that occasioned a whole bunch of intelligence community, Department of Energy contractors, Air Force nuclear detection, presidential panels looking into this. And what I found in my research is that with the exception of the presidential panel, every group that looked into it believed it was a nuclear test. So, I mean, I don't have any basis for, simply on the basis of examining the data myself, drawing a conclusion, but everybody I talked to other than this presidential panel thought it was a test. It's pretty clear that it wouldn't have been the South Africans alone, because at that time they didn't have even the fissile material to produce a bomb, and secondly, the signature from that type of, the signature that was picked up, which was of a very low yield weapon, was not consistent with the bombs that South Africa eventually built. If it was a detonation, you know, the best guess was that it was an Israeli neutron weapon that was being tested. best guess if it was, but I can't tell you that it was.
There was an article in the Scientific American about a year ago, I think, written by two gentlemen who literally claimed to have carried depleted uranium in suitcases around Europe and thereafter to fly from Milan to the United States and travel through here. Is that true?
Well, it's true that there was an article.
Yes. The article's true. I know that.
Yeah, I think it was Tom Cochran from NRDC and somebody else. Right. Yeah, I don't have any reason to believe it's not true. And certainly there have been tests by GAO and others where nuclear material has been smuggled in one way or another. I mean, it's certainly not beyond belief that can be done.
Question over here.
Thank you. I feel as secure with Nest having you around as I felt secure before 9/11 with our CIA and everything else. I, having heard from you, I have not read your book yet. I feel is as secure as we feel that, you know, we put some mouse traps, 5, 10 mouse traps in our house and not keep our house clean, keep an open trash, and feel very safe. I got mouse trash. But that brings me to my real question. There are four, basically, sources of danger of Armageddon, be it local or far wider. One is the Cuban missile crisis or accidental thinking by one of the major powers. And we know that we have had many, many of that. That is one. Second is all of the ones that you said, the nuclear bomb dropping here and there. I'm not sure if you mentioned that only a couple of years ago, a nuclear-powered B-52 bomber was missing, and nobody knew it was missing for 17 hours. Mm-hmm. So that is two. Third is the nuclear terrorism that Graham Allison gave us a lot of fear about, and you talked about. And the fourth is what Dr. Helen Caldicott is shouting her lungs out, is coming out of the nuclear reactors. Mm-hmm. Okay, we had right here in Santa Susana Pass, we had a meltdown that was 3 times bigger than the Three Mile Island. So these are the four sources of the potential Armageddon.
Mm-hmm. And your question?
So the question is, which of these four do you think are most probable? I agree with that, Helen Caldicott, that the one that we will lose here is the most.
I don't really have any opinion one way or the other because I haven't really thought of it in those terms. I mean, I think to respond to something you said at the beginning, how likely Nest will be to, you know, detect it is, you know, certainly something we don't know, as I said, but it's an insurance policy that doesn't cost very much and represents the last line of defense. But other than that, I'd say that you can go through, you know, history with regard to nuclear weapons, and there have always been these, you know, very alarmed claims that, you know, disaster is around the corner if we don't do X, Y, and Z. And it hasn't occurred yet, it may occur, but people often who have said that if things continue on this path, we're doomed, turned out to be wrong. Going back to nuclear scientists at the sort of beginning of the Cold War. So I wouldn't dismiss any of those things, and all of those things merit, you know, significant attention, but I couldn't, you know, if I told you a probability number, I'd just be making it up, so I won't.
Back there.
I was wondering about dirty bombs. Have there been any actual incidents of material going missing or being stolen first? And second, how much actual material do you need to make something significant?
As far as stuff going missing, certainly there have been medical devices that have been lost. Nest, in 2003, Nest was doing searches of a lot of American cities because there was some intelligence that indicated something might be up. And in Las Vegas, they detected this radiological source. They eventually found it was under some homeless person's pillow, and it was a medical device that he had actually sort of, you know, picked up a little while before. Somebody walked into a gun store in Virginia with something that was some device that was radioactive. Other stuff has been stolen in various places across the world. So certainly stuff has gone missing, been lost, stolen, whatever. And as far as how much you need, I guess it depends on how much effect you want to have. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen any charts that say X number of pounds for this amount of impact or contamination for a dirty bomb. I mean, you would be using cobalt or cesium or whatever. And you know, the more you pack in, the more contamination you're going to get.
Over here.
Yes, it seems like we're not getting a lot of bang for our buck out of this organization. And I'm just wondering what the budget is for NEST.
Well, actually, it's, you know, only in the millions of dollars, tens of millions, whatever. But, I mean, most of, you're not really paying for these people to work for NEST. You're paying them to do their other jobs. So they're doing it free. I mean, so you're getting a bargain. I mean, these are people who, say, work in weapons diagnostics or health physics or radiation detection for the labs, and they have their jobs completely aside from NEST. NEST is something they're asked to do voluntarily. And so, you know, you have 850 to 1,000 people on the payroll, and the personnel costs are essentially zero. So, you know.
Are there any problems with quick response if there really was a threat, getting individuals together from those other places in order to respond quickly?
Well, there are, there are people who aren't alert and they have beepers, and, you know, so if you want to contact them, you can contact them pretty immediately. And the people who are on alert are not going to be, you know, vacationing in Brazil at the time when they are on alert. So certainly you have plans to get Air Force planes to the appropriate bases and the people and the equipment there. And that's something they certainly practiced a lot since the mid-1990s, is being able to do this in a reasonable amount of time.
Did the NEST cooperate with you in your writing of this book?
No. In the mid-1990s, they were, fairly cooperative. I mean, they had NBC out there, and they gave them a nice briefing and slides and took them on a experimental, you know, sort of a mock mission, but they become more secretive after 9/11, and certainly the only thing they did for me was scan some photos from one of their histories. So the people I talked to were retired people, some of them who were, you know, very senior, involved in the program for a long amount of time, and documents that I got under the Freedom of Information Act. At least in one case where they try to claim it was exempt under grounds that it really wasn't exempt, but that plus basic research were really the sources of information.
Yes, this gentleman right there.
At what distance is a nuclear device detectable, as if you were looking for it in the city?
If it's a nuclear device, fairly close, but I couldn't tell you how close because I think, I don't know, but it's also classified because it depends on the capability of the equipment, depends on the nature of the device, whether it's plutonium, uranium, how well it's built. If it's a dirty bomb, what I can tell you is that it's detectable from certainly a helicopter above. Somebody I spoke to said that because of the material that's used in a dirty bomb is much different than a nuclear device. And somebody I spoke to said that, you know, that was, you know, hot as gangbusters, and if you were, you know, anywhere in the vicinity, you could detect it. But as far as a nuclear device, I mean, the fact that you need to have people, or that you have people going around with nuclear detection equipment in suitcases and briefcases that they're carrying, tells you something about having to get pretty close in a lot of these cases. Because if they could do it from a standoff distance, you wouldn't necessarily need to do that so much.
One more question in the back.
We've talked a lot about nuclear weapons. Does NEST have, perchance, a secondary mission of keeping tabs or watching out for chemical and or biological weapons?
No. There have been proposals for similar organizations, one which would be called BEST, the Biological Emergency Search Team. One reason that that's never happened is where with a nuclear device, there's one point, or a dirty bomb, there's one point. A biological attack can be spread, you know, over a series of areas. So you're not looking for one single device. The you know, people might be spreading it all over a subway or an area. So it's been more. There hasn't been sort of the same rationale for a BEST organization as there is for NEST.
Well, we've come to the end of our allotted time. Thank you very much, Jeffrey, for being with the Aloud series again. It's a fascinating book. I hope a lot of people will go out and buy copies. And I want to remind you that you can... that.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.